Hello and welcome to Asia Matters, the podcast where we look to go behind the headlines to discuss the most important stories in the world's most fascinating region. I'm Andrew People. All eyes have been on China recently as the 20th Communist Party Congress drew to a close and Xi Jinping was confirmed as leader for a historic third term. Our guest this episode is one of the UK's leading academics on China, Kerry Brown. He's a prolific author and started his career as a diplomat in the British Embassy in Beijing in the 1990s. This show was recorded live in London about a week and a half ago in conjunction with the Lao Institute at King's College, where Kerry is Professor of Chinese Studies. We talked about two of his most recent books. Firstly, Xi, A Study in Power, which looks at the rise of China's leader and where his rule might be headed. And secondly, a fascinating collection that Kerry has put together with Gemma Chenger Den, called China Through European Eyes. In it, they take excerpts from writings on China by thinkers from Marco Polo to Voltaire and Karl Marx to Simone de Beauvoir, looking at the ways in which they have interacted with and interpreted the country. So without further ado, let's jump in. Kerry, thank you so much for joining us. It's a great pleasure to be talking to you today.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
I'm going to dive in. We're talking during the 20th National People's Congress in Beijing, still ongoing, another couple of days to go. Still, it's pretty obvious by now that Xi is going to get this third term, at least as China's leader. So my first question to you is, was that ever really in doubt?
Yeah, I noticed the Sun political correspondent Harry Coles has written a book recently called Liz Truss, Her Rise and Rise to Power. And I have to say, that's going to come out in December. I can prove that writing about an autocrat is way more predictable than writing about a democratic leader. So I guess that's proved one thing. I mean, so on Sunday, we might all have a bit of a shock and maybe there'll be differences, but I think it's most unlikely. And I think it's unlikely because the messaging has been overwhelmingly for the key leader to continue. And because it's the sort of main investment the party's made, right? I mean, it's invested so much in this kind of persona that Xi has got. And, you know, I think someone was reviewing the book on Xi for The Spectator and they said, you know, who is Xi really? You know, I mean, what's his personality? I don't know whether that exists anymore. You know, it's sort of like this extraordinary kind of like collective construction, really. But I think it's pretty likely that on Sunday there'll be, you know, he'll march out with whoever's behind him. I don't know. I mean, there might be five people, there might be seven people, but, you know, when everyone's going to agree with you, no matter what you say, what does it matter?
Absolutely. We saw the speech last Sunday. What did you take away from that speech? What have you taken away from the last few days in terms of any changes to the policy direction that China's taking, that Xi is taking?
Well, these congresses are the world's sort of biggest political theater, you know, and like going to see a play that you've seen before and you know the ending, you often kind of, I mean, I don't know, I've followed probably four, five of these congresses now over the years. And this one is the one where the ending is most predictable, I suppose. But I don't know whether that's made me complacent. What I've seen, I suppose, is this enormous act of affirmation. It's all very, very clear in that long speech. I mean, actually, you know, the written text was longer, but mercifully he left out an hour and a half. And I kind of feel that the things that were said there, again, none of it's a surprise. I mean, in politics in China has never really been about surprises. Surprises are not a good thing. I suppose if you think of party conferences in Britain, I mean, they've got to grab people's attention. There's competition from a lot of other things, including other party conferences, right? Whereas in China, I mean, there's no competition. It's got to be about an affirmation of a message. And so the whole kind of event is really to convey that pretty sort of reassuring, you know, standard, we believe in this, this is what we're going to do. But the only thing that was probably interesting was the quite hard language on Taiwan. Apart from that, I think most of the other things would have been weird if they weren't there and were not particularly startling because they were there.
Much of the commentary I've seen has talked about there being a lot of continuity, as you say, not too many surprises from what we've heard over the last few years. And what you tend to get then with these speeches is people look quite closely and they count up the number of times that certain words were mentioned. And I think one thing that's come out of that is he talked quite a lot about development as normal in terms of China's economy. But there also seems, some people have pointed to, as a stress on
security and China's security. Can you explain what the background to that sort of shift in emphasis might be?
Yeah, look, I mean, people say, you know, China's obviously changed a lot under Xi, and especially in the last 5 years. But there has to be a recognition that the outside world is often what politics in China is responding to. I mean, the attitude of America, the attitude of, you know, China's neighbors, but particularly America, is extremely important. And that world has become really different, even from when Xi came to power, you know, in 2012. It's very divided. It's very unstable. It's not very predictable. China is now in the business of manufacturing predictability, which was not the case when I first started dealing with China in the 1990s, where it was always about, oh my God, you know, is China stable? I mean, David Shamberg, I remember, wrote a whole kind of book about, is China going to fall apart? And, you know, what happened is obviously completely different, that in many ways, economically and politically, the world outside has fallen apart. Now, that language about security, part of it is that China has always been, you know, very, very obsessed by security for maybe very good reasons, you know. Part of it is actually because the outside world is definitely nowhere near as predictable and easy to deal with for China. So it's a much more symbiotic relationship. And I kind of think one day we'll probably think the Xi Jinping leadership is going to make sense because the world was the way it was, with the divisions and instabilities and problems and lack of consensus, which meant that this very nationalistic, populist kind of leadership kind of had more of a rationale and a driving force to it than would have been otherwise if the world outside were less unpredictable and unreassuring.
And they're feeling that from primarily America, you know, the latest moves we've seen on the technology front in particular. Do you think they're feeling more insecure and hence the stress on security?
Yeah, I think so. I think, and well, one issue is that you got a real possibility in 2024, and if not before, of China panicking into doing something intemperate on Taiwan. And remember, the consequences of that will be catastrophic. You know, if China were to really push to use military means or more aggressive means, that would mean, you know, the strong likelihood that America and China would come into conflict. And I mean, that's no joke, right? I mean, people often sort of talk this up, and you get a lot of kind of more hawkish people in America and in Europe and elsewhere saying, yeah, we should sort of really push towards this. But this is going to be like an economic and military and global catastrophe. So I kind of think the fact that China is panicking a little bit about American politicians maybe, you know, getting very involved in this issue and even crossing the ultimate red line and recognizing Taiwanese autonomy or independence is not, you know, a panicking China is not a good thing, nor is an America which is really being adventurous in this issue. The investment in the last decades has been status quo, very boring, very, very boring, but probably the only sustainable approach. And that is eroded now. That's really eroded.
So let's talk a little bit about Xi Jinping, the man, as you talk about him in your book. One of the most striking things I thought that you wrote about in the book is really seeing Xi as a man of faith, and a man of faith in the Communist Party, really as the only institution that can keep China stable and bring it to its sort of rightful place in world affairs. And from this flows a lot of what we've seen under his rule already, the anti-corruption campaigns, the crackdowns on the tech sector, the repressive policies in Xinjiang, and so on. Can you talk a little bit more about this idea of faith and why it's so key to how you see Xi Jinping and his rule over China?
It's really a puzzle how one individual has ended up so dominant over such a complex and difficult country. You know, it seems sort of counterintuitive in a way. You more complicated China gets, maybe the more difficult it gets to govern, and yet that seems not to be the case. I think this idea of his leadership being an expression of sort of collective faith kind of made sense to me. You know, this is Xi Jinping is a born-again communist, right? I mean, you know, sort of tried to join the party 10 times in 1974, I think. He kind of speaks in this very priestly way. I mean, I look at speeches he made before he became the kind of key leader in the early 2000s, Zhejiang Xinyu, which is this sort of collection of his, I mean, maybe they were authored by other people, but they, you know, kind of issued while he was a party secretary. And he has this sort of, you know, the party must be clean and above reproach. And I remember, maybe some of you remember at that time, in China, it was very hard to work out the difference between party officials and business people. They were all on the, you know, kind of doing business. I think the fact that he's reasserted the importance of the, you know, the key sector that the Communist Party in is politics, and it's salvation politics. You know, it's to save the great nation. It's the only kind of vehicle that is going to get to that great spiritual mission. We use sort of a lot of kind of utilitarian or almost like mechanical language about politics in China. But if you think of it in more sort of, I'd say, spiritual terms, I'm not saying that I see it spiritually, but if you think of it in more kind of religious or spiritual terms, this sort of politics kind of works. You know, it's an appeal to people's faith, emotions. You know, the people that are going to appear on Sunday, I think is when the new Politburo appear. These are going to be the people who are the true believers. And it's hard to quantify that, but they must manifest their belief in doing things above and beyond what they rationally believe and understand. You know, it's kind of very hard to describe Chinese politics without falling back on these notions of faith, loyalty, trust, and the party having this kind of spiritual mission. But to me, I can't see any way you can understand it apart from that.
And yet, one of the things that always strikes me about people like Xi is you look into their personal biographies and that there's been a lot of suffering, right, at the hands of the party itself. I mean, Xi himself sent off to the countryside in his youth, his father, one of the famous leaders of the Communist Revolution, nevertheless suffered greatly at the hands of Mao and so on at various times. What is it about the party? What is it about these people that still makes them so faithful to it, even though it's been responsible for personal suffering in many cases?
But he survived, so he has experienced the party's mercy. And, you know, what more powerful thing? If you are a believer, you, of course, deserve suffering. You deserve to be wiped out. I mean, it's just this kind of sense that having been through that, his family and he were spared and were able then to repay the party and Mao's kind of, you know, sort of saving of them with their powerful missionary faith now. I mean, it's not weird that people who have suffered badly are then grateful. I mean, I'm not going to apply this to British politics. That might be a little bit too extreme because there are levels of suffering beyond anything that anyone can put up with. However, I think in Chinese politics, this sort of sense of mission is quite palpable.
And he does talk about that period in his youth, doesn't he? Can you talk a little bit about what happened to him and that sort of biography he had before becoming a national political figure?
Sure. I mean, he was sent down quite young. I mean, the usual age was, I think, 16 or 17 in the sort of sent down movement. And he was sent down, I think, in it's either early 69, I believe, when he would have been just maybe 15 and a half. So he was sent to Yan'an, but that's Yan'an, which is quite a big area. I mean, he was sent to one of the sort of townships, I believe, and then into the village and lived there for 7 years, but had different experiences and ended up actually after becoming a Communist Party member in 1974 as a sort of local party, you know, secretary for his village. And there's these sort of stories. In fact, you can find online actual kind of contemporary press accounts of, you know, this model young worker Xi Jinping in, I think, 75. But after that, you know, he went to Beijing, to Tsinghua University as a special arrangement. I think other people at that time also had this special arrangement. Briefly, was a military, you know, kind of in the military, and then afterwards in civilian governance. So do we know that story? Are there archives about that story? Not easy to find. You know, you can't go to Beijing and dig this stuff up, not without having problems. But it's interesting what's been made of that story, you know, the narrative of Xi Jinping. I mean, Hu Jintao was the man from nowhere, right? I don't even know to this day where he was born. Was it Shanghai or Anhui or whatever? Xi Jinping is the man from everywhere. You know, yeah. I mean, he's like everywhere. He's the everyman. And that story has been used in, you know, state narratives, and it's been used as an asset. And I think that alone is interesting. Not so much do I know the story is true, but I sure know that that story has been used a lot.
And then he spends a long time as a party official in Fujian and then Zhejiang province. What do you think those experiences gave him?
So he's got a lot of experience at these provincial levels. I mean, Fujian is interesting because, of course, it had a lot of involvement with Taiwan. So people earlier on in his career as a national leader fought this closeness to Taiwan and the fact, I think his wife has got, Peng Luyan has got relatives in Taiwan, I believe, that this would sort of give him intimacy or a sort of more flexible attitude towards Taiwan. That obviously is not sort of so easy to say now. And Zhejiang, though, I suppose it's a sort of 5 years that he spent there is relatively well documented. And it was clear that he was already sort of figuring in national leadership possibilities. But to be honest, as you probably remember, Andrew, I mean, it wasn't really until quite late, I think very, very late in 2007, when I met him in Shanghai. Of course, that's when things got good for him. That was the secret. We had a shake of the hand, a deep look at each other, and he said, wow, I'm going to win and you're going to... No. So, I mean, it was at that point, not when we met, well, not completely. It was around about that time that I guess he managed to become... He was more thought about, but not until very, very late.
Because people thought Li Keqiang really was going to get the top job, didn't they?
Indeed.
For quite a long time. Mm. So fast forward to his period of rule. I mean, another striking idea in the book you have at one point is this idea that almost Xi is an actor in a play, and he's almost sublimated his own personality into this greater cause of the Communist Party. I'm not explaining it that well. Maybe you could explain it a little bit better, this idea that you have there.
This really to sort of try and answer this question of how did this quite complicated story become about one person. I mean, I find it more and more bizarre that this enormously complicated country with so many different socioeconomic groups and, you know, different sorts of people and their experiences has become this story of one person. And it seems only to make sense as an institution. What has changed in the last 60 years is the party has institutionalized, but in a quite hard to define way. It's definitely got an identity now, which is much stronger, a collective identity, a corporate identity, which is much stronger than even 30 years ago, even 40 years ago. And that matters. So what is Xi Jinping representing? I mean, he's not going to be eternal, but the party might be. And it's sort of this idea of a faith community, which is trying to construct this hugely important thing throughout Chinese modern history of, you know, a powerful, rich Chinese nation. And I think a lot of the politics, if you think one person who I'm pretty certain is going to appear on Sunday will be Wang Huning. And he's really the kind of person that matters in a weird way because his ideas have such importance. And they are primarily about identity and culture. The power of contemporary China, I think, it's not in the economy. It's not really, easily in the political system. The political system is often kind of maybe an impediment. It's in culture and identity. And I think that has gone stronger. If you think of this idea that Xi Jinping has an answer to one of the really key questions, right? Who are we? You know, you can say now, we are Chinese. We are proud. We are strong. You know, we have all these things and we're feared. You know, we're not laughed at anymore. We're feared. That's cool. And I think that question of who are we in America or Europe is more vexed, you know, to come onto the European thing. I mean, it's this really kind of this issue of we don't really have an easy answer to the question of who are we. But I think the investment in China has been into, there's an answer to that question. And it's quite potent. It's very potent politics.
I guess it's important to remember that when he comes into office, I mean, make or break is probably pushing it too far, but it's a moment of fragility for the Communist Party. You've got all this corruption that's rampant through the go-go years of China's growth. You have the Bolshevik fiasco and so on. So I guess coalescing around this one man, this one idea was pretty important in terms of re-establishing the party's rule over China.
Yeah, and I think that's why the figure of Wang Huning is so key, because he was there long before Xi. I mean, he was a key ideologue and a key thinker in the mid-90s and was the architect of all of the kind of ideological positions that the three represents, the Sangha Daibiao, the kind of scientific development, you know, and then the China dream. That obviously shows that these ideas are a sort of continuum. They're not separate. There's this idea of an organic kind of development. And the fact that Xi Jinping's politics is an expression of that process, it's not really a big innovation. It's the development of that and part of that tradition. So I don't see it as something that is purely about this person coming along with agency and saying, right, I'm going to do this according to the way I want to. I think it was much more collective and much more organic.
At a practical level now, though, as we go into this third term and maybe beyond for Xi, is there a danger that he becomes a more isolated figure, that he becomes maybe, you know, as people say about Putin, somebody that people can't bring him bad news, and some of his old allies, you know, they've got older and they've left the stage somewhat. Do you see that sort of danger? You get this sort of even more of a big man problem in China.
I do, yeah. I think that is a real problem. Putin obviously is a good example of someone who's not really welcomed bad news, and it's had really terrible consequences. And Xi Jinping is multiple orders of that. I mean, it's hard to think of people saying to him, you know, this is a really dumb idea, Comrade Xi, can you just sort of go and think about it? You know, how would that career move go? You know, it wouldn't be very easy. And I think there is a real danger because of the enormous centrality of his charisma and persona in this politics, that there will be no contestation. And I guess we see some clues, very small protests in Beijing at this week. But the fact that they're happening at all is kind of interesting, although, of course, you can over-interpret them. But also, you know, kind of maybe a lot of disgruntlement about the zero COVID lockdowns, which are taking a real toll. And some people in the audience probably have experienced these in China. And a sort of feeling that if the economy isn't good, which is possible, it's already in a really tough place, what are the answers to that? And Xi and his, they're going to have answers to that pretty quick.
Yeah, I was going to ask, what other vulnerabilities do you see now going forward for China? I mean, you write again in the book about how much of Xi's success is down to telling this story of success in China, and that, you know, the party is the institution that will help China achieve this goal of being a moderately prosperous society and so on. So much of the persona is around this idea that we are successful, we are bringing success to China. Aside from COVID and so on, where else do you see the sort of vulnerabilities to that story in the sort of near to medium term?
Well, I mean, so the immediate issue is what do you do with the, you know, kind of housing market, the huge pressures on growth, unemployment, quite high. I don't know what the actual statistic is, but it's clear it's very high. And this constant need to really decouple from a pernicious and irritating outside world. The feeling is mutual. I mean, America is also deeply into decoupling, as we saw with Biden's semiconductor, you know. But the reality is that there can't be any decoupling. I mean, the pandemic has proved this is a pretty flat world now, and environmental issues, it's hard. How can you decouple each other? You know, if you're going to solve it, you'll solve it together, or if you won't solve it. I kind of think if we survive 100 years, if there is one thing that the Xi leadership will maybe be remembered for, if it doesn't do anything crazy on Taiwan, will be doing something about climate change. I think that's the thing that should be the focus of all engagement too, that if it's right what is being, and I have no reason to doubt this, right, we're being told about the critical, you know, states of the environment, China is absolutely key to that. And it's the area it speaks, and he spoke last Sunday about this in Beijing, where there's a common language. And that surely is a big, big relief. If we were facing a China that didn't accept that, we would really have a problem. So I guess if that is the focus for all of our diplomacy and work together, other things can happen. At least we've got that. So we should be positive about that.
Talking of finding a common language, let's move on to your second book, absolutely fascinating, China Through European Eyes. Can you tell us, well, first of all, why is this the moment for this book? Why you decided to put it together, and what the sort of main themes of it are?
Yeah, so I was writing a book about decoupling and a great sort of divide between China and the West, meaning principally America and its alliance system. And I kind of was referring to the Enlightenment West and realized I didn't have a clue what I was talking about. Then thinking about how often in the past these figures in European history had been referenced, that I'd never really read what they had written about China. And I kind of put together this group of 16 from Marco Polo, because he's, of course, the great, and in the beginning, whatever one's views about whether that account was realistic or not.
Whether he really went there or not.
Indeed. But also great Enlightenment figures. And the thing that I found really interesting was that the debate that we have today in Europe and in Britain about, on the one hand, a kind of fear, I suppose, and a worry and anxiety about China, And on the other, you know, sort of recent past, at least, maybe not so much today, a kind of idealization of China often, that these were very well established and figures from 400 years ago had taken very positions. This, the structure of European attitudes towards China is long standing. It's well, you know, kind of established. It just seems to get retold every generation and forgotten before it gets retold. It's also cyclical. So at the moment, we're really in a demonization position or a anxiety position. But I mean, it's often been very idealistic.
Yeah, it's fascinating. And of course, there's another strand which basically sees China as a market opportunity as well. And that comes through the book as well. Do you think these ways of that these European thinkers have thought about China, to what extent have they got in the way of just simply taking China on its own terms, listening to Chinese people, talking to them about their lives, their thoughts, their hopes, their beliefs, and so on?
Well, unmediated China or China on its own terms is also probably a myth. I mean, because we're always somewhere and we're always looking at something, we being Europeans looking at China, we can't pretend that we're somehow sort of transcendent to that. And this book is a sort of recognition for that. Actually, a lot of the time, European, you know, kind of thinking, particularly, and British as a sort of subset of that, but to sort of talk about European thinking, is often not contextualized. It's not located somewhere. We have this long history. It's a really long history, and it's extremely well documented. And it's the great figures that I've used, they are not figures that are at all specialist on China. They're just great intellectual figures. Leibniz, you know, Voltaire, Montesquieu, Hegel, you know, Marx, who wrote scathing things about China. You know, I mean, they're really significant figures for the development of intellectual, you know, kind of culture in Europe. But they all had thoughts about China. And they all contributed, I suppose, to this background noise. You know, today, we as Europeans, we sort of live in that historic context, but probably without a great deal of awareness of it. And I think to admit that our relations with China actually are extremely conditioned by a fairly long history, which is not inaccessible, I think kind of gives, at least that history should give some answers. The questions we are facing today about how we deal with a very different set of values in China and the rest are not new questions. They have been questions that really amazing people have been thinking about for a long time. And I just wanted to make those thinkers, you know, kind of more accessible.
And it's striking, of course, because a lot of the earlier thinkers, very few of them had been anywhere near China as well. And yet they write in a very clear and quite knowledgeable way about China and what they've learned about the place. It's very interesting. To what extent do you think that a sort of distinctive European way of looking at China has developed that we can sort of discern today, as opposed to an American view or an African view or the view of other Asian nations?
Well, I suppose the simple answer to a very complicated issue is that values were always there and always mattered, but it's hard to spell out what it means. And any discussion today about China is going to implicitly or explicitly touch on that. Values. It's sort of interesting that this idealization or demonization of whatever was thought about China, it seemed that the problem was often that here was a kind of power or an entity that had extremely kind of hybrid thinking and didn't believe one thing, believed, you know, kind of Confucianism and Buddhism and, you know, all these sort of different ideas, even in the sort of Enlightenment period. And for Europeans, I think that was the big problem. The Enlightenment project was a very tidy one, right? You want unity and you want to create a sort of, you know, universal framework in principle. And here you have a sort of power that is sort of violating that and really problematic. And I think in essence, that's still a problem. You know, this kind of power that sort of is not saying we want you to adopt our values because you're not Chinese, so how can you adopt Chinese values? But then is also saying, but we're not going to adopt your values. You think are universalist. I mean, that's sort of tricky, right? I mean, it's not a power coming along and saying that you believe dumb things, we believe smart things, so you've got to adopt what we have to say. It's actually saying you can believe what you like, but we're going to believe what we want. And that's a really different kind of challenge.
Taking you back a bit to your diplomat days and also putting both of these books together in a way and bringing it to the present day, I mean, I think it's a time that we're going through where countries in Europe, they're having a bit of a rethink about their approach to China right now. What do you advise? Do we look at China? Do we say, okay, look, it's just a market. Let's carry on Volkswagen. Let's carry on doing business with China. And we'll sort of mention human rights, but we'll kind of keep that quiet. Or do we join in this more aggressive approach that's been spearheaded by Trump and carried on by Biden? Mm. Big question.
Right.
What are your thoughts on that?
I guess. So for me as a person, I can only really contribute. So what I'm working on at the moment is a history of Britain's relations with China from the beginning. So that's from about 15, I think the first recorded contact was Elizabeth I writing a letter to the Wanli Emperor in 1586. Portuguese and others obviously had much earlier contacts, so their histories are different. But the thing that I find most frustrating listening to the debate about China in Britain is the fact that there is no historic awareness. In essence, you have a China which has a narrative about us, whether we like it or, I mean, the unequal treaties and all that stuff. It has a narrative, right? And we don't have a counter narrative, either because we are kind of uneasy about colonization, imperialism, these things, or because we just couldn't be bothered to find out. This history for Britain is actually, again, a really, really well-documented one, and actually one that has lots and lots of cases of, you know, what did Britain want? You know, often it was described just as trade, but trade is never just about trade. I mean, it's about power structures. I mean, and lots of it is actually really kind of sort of interesting to know. I mean, so a bit of Trivial Pursuit. The first British person who is recorded to have, you know, learnt Chinese, I think his name was James Flint. And he was rewarded by that for going to Beijing and daring to try and get an audience with the emperor in about 1756 by being shut in jail for 4 years and then booted out of the country. Anyway, the person who taught him Chinese had their head chopped off. So, you know, and I mean, the second thing that I found was how often this idea has been, you know, kind of strong from really the 19th century that British didn't know about China. You know, and that they didn't have the knowledge assets. And it's weird because you could say that today, but actually, if you think there's a question of, you know, not knowing, and there's a question of deliberately desiring not to know. And I think it's sort of very hard today to sort of not know about China. You have to really work at it. And we have to say there are some people I know who really do work at it. But, you know, it seems to me a sort of almost like a pathology that the investment in this sort of, you know, adventure of misunderstanding or just wanting to not know. It's not really about China. It's about a kind of unease that, again, this thing about, you know, kind of with the Europeans, and unease with something that is not really a very obvious and easy to pin down threat.
And can we steer that sort of path sort of between the extreme hawkishness and, but also at the same time, representing our values in our relations with China?
The whole of the last 400 years for Britain and for Europe, the default has been we are strong and China's weak. That's true economically and militarily in all sorts of ways. And the radical change today is a China which is not weak. That's the historic change. So to change a mindset which has been in place for a long time is really hard. If you look at a lot of the language used publicly about China, the assumption of China possibly being weaker is still there. The idea that China should be talked to in certain ways and sort of sign up to certain things because it's not a Western power, it's a weaker power. And I don't see any way of solving this cognitive dissonance unless we radically reevaluate that and accept that that China has disappeared and now it is a China which is strong.
We have to take China on its own terms and we have to improve our understanding. It's been a great opportunity for me to ask lots of questions, but now I want to throw it over to the audience now. Yes, please, in the front row, sorry.
Thank you. My name is Yubing, and very nice to come here.
I think the thought police are coming for me. Sorry.
British or Chinese?
I have one question actually about China and also UK's relations, because recently we saw lots of like different opinions on this bilateral relations. I know some people, especially like in parliament, they positioning China as hostile countries together with Russia. And do you agree with this kind of like label or the position? How do you see the future of these two countries? I mean, lots of people think UK is following US too much on the foreign policies, and its lack of its own independence. So it makes UK a very awkward position of dealing with the issues like the China.
Yeah, I mean, when politicians in Britain in particular talk about China's hostility or being a threat, I mean, who are they talking to? I mean, I think they're talking domestically. So there are obviously an audience and a kind of an appetite for that within Britain. But it doesn't deal with the issue I've just referred to, which is that practically there's a whole set of questions where we and China are in the same position: climate change, pandemics up to a point, even economic issues, we're in the same position up to a point. And then there's a set of issues where we are going to disagree, right? I mean, we've never agreed, so we will just have to, I mean, human rights, you mentioned, is it no point really talking about that, at least in an abstract sense, though there's specific issues that you might want to talk to. I mean, to me, the problem is that I completely understand why it would be very, you know, people would have strong views on China's behavior in Xinjiang, in Hong Kong, in Tibet, in dissident, you know, kind of issues. I can understand that. But if you're talking about how do you actually argue your case with the Chinese government to go and say you're doing the wrong thing and, you know, you're bad, it's not going to get any change. I mean, I've seen it happen. It doesn't, you know, work. I was part of an EU dialogue, you know, kind of on human rights with China. We went to China in about 2011 and had these discussions. We stayed in a fantastic hotel, the best food I've ever had in China, really, really great luxury hotel. And we talked about human rights. But I mean, do we kind of talk productively? I don't think so. Obviously not. I mean, because the China we see today obviously is not what was desired. So I know that it's easy to sort of answer the question of how do we condemn China. That's really easy. But how do we actually persuade? I don't know. I mean, I don't know the language that one's got to use about expressing productively deep anxiety and worry about, for instance, the situation in Xinjiang. You know, the debate about this in Britain is quite difficult because as soon as you say, you know, if you don't condemn it, then people think you're apologizing for it. No, I completely accept it's a terrible situation. But how do you have a productive and useful conversation with the only people on the planet who can do something about the situation in Xinjiang? And that is the Chinese leadership in Beijing. Not easy.
Hi, thank you so much for coming. I'm actually from Hangzhou and I actually went to the same high school as Xi Jinping's daughter. And my question is, to what extent do you think that the existing sanctions on Russia could produce an effective deterrence effect on China and in order to constrain its ambitions on Taiwan?
I don't think they would have much of an effect because the Russian economy is a sixth the size of the Chinese economy. The Chinese economy is way more integrated into the, you know, the global economy. It's the chief trading partner to 120 countries. The sanctions list was all European countries, obviously North America, Australia, Japan, South Korea, etc. I mean, 150 plus countries it didn't include. No African countries, Middle Eastern countries or Latin American countries. So, I mean, China's got options with this alternative world. It can deal with sanctions. It might even be able to deal with sanctions better than those sanctioning it. So I don't think it's really an option.
Professor, I was wondering how you see the tension between China claims to be multilateralist while on the international stage, like China is trying to push forward many like geopolitical projects like the Belt and Road Initiative. That doesn't necessarily constitute part of the existing multilateral institutions that under, for example, the UN system.
Yeah, I mean, I can't think of many multilateral organizations that China doesn't participate in, though. I mean, it's a multilateralist. The problem is when it either seeks leadership in those or it creates its own multilateral organizations like the Asia Infrastructure Investment Bank or things like this. So is it that China is coming in and wanting to redo these organizations and you know, kind of take the world over that way? I don't think it's so dramatic. I think that it is such a significant and big player, but with a different political model means participating per se will be a problem. you know, even the act of participating. I can also understand why China would want a sort of global order which was a bit more representative of its desires, because it's a fifth of global GDP. So that's not a mystery. I am puzzled by why something like the Belt and Road, which I find quite mysterious and elusive in a way, gets people to panic so much. You know, I don't know why we're panicking so much. I mean, I kind of think it's really strange in 2008-09 when the great economic, you know, crisis happened. Chinese investment started to come to London. I remember being told by bankers and others then, we don't need to worry because, you know, our rule of law and everything, if people come, they're going to have to, you know, act according to our rules. And that confidence has definitely gone now. And now we're kind of panicking like hell that, you know, everything that China does is definitely going to be a problem. Confucius Institutes, you know, the Belt and Road and these kinds of things. I'm skeptical. I'm just really, really skeptical. I don't know, maybe I've spent too much time in China, but I'm really, really skeptical.
Just tie a few things you said together. You mentioned about the geopolitical situation, or the chaotic one now, making sense of Xi Jinping's activity. And you also mentioned that, or in an article I think you released very recently, about hawkish narratives creating more and more hawkish narratives, which then people subscribe to. So my question there is, when you said, how do we speak to China about things like Xinjiang? But my question is to you, how do we speak to China? What opportunity needs to present itself that we can reverse this trajectory of constant negativity?
Yeah, I mean, a kind of more difficult answer is that we need to kind of know exactly what we are promoting, right? And be realistic. And I can see that there may be intricate policy sort of arguments where you could try and say, this is ultimately a self-defeating policy in Xinjiang, okay? I mean, I've tried that in Beijing. I tried it about 3 years ago with someone from the PLA, and it didn't go well. But I think you've got to know a lot about these issues to be able to get anywhere. I guess in Britain, much more work is being done now on trying to get experts involved in these sorts of dialogues, which is good. There's a consciousness that we have a lack of people who really have decent specialist or technical knowledge. I mean, you're obviously now sort of also helping to answer that in government positions. But I suppose the most difficult thing in Britain is our politicians. I mean, because their political position may be nothing to do with a, you know, accurate or a technical analysis of something. It's about a political position. I mean, yesterday a journalist, a very political journalist in one newspaper said, anyone in Britain with any connection with China should not be allowed to have any official position at all. I mean, okay, I mean, how do you define that? I'm definitely doomed. I mean, and I presume most people in this room are just coming here tonight. You are undertaking an act of subversion. You know, this is very ridiculous. So I suppose you've got to have some conceptual clarity. It's just a negative response, but I don't think the way we do it at the moment works, right? And over 25 years, 30 years of the human rights dialogues with China and all of that, we have to be honest and admit this is not the outcome that we were working on. So we have to kind of work out how that happened. Because at the beginning, before 1989, I think it was that Western values were looked up to, were attractive. We had a great, you know, offer. I think people really, you know, really did have an interest. And something has not happened that was expected to happen. And I think we just have to have an honest debate about that. This is not justifying how we've ended up here, but actually understanding how. How did that happen? Because clearly this is not what was expected.
Why do you think you get, you know, that interlocutor you had from the PLA in China? Why do you think you get such a sort of blank answer from him? I mean, why, you know, when you say things like, look, you know, as well as being a policy we disagree with, this is doing you real harm. You know, this is doing your image real harm.
But that,
Why is it a skilled journalist?
He saw the opening. So this, I mean, this is the really interesting thing, because in fact, that one of the most difficult things about this debate that we had in China in, I think, middle of 2019 was a row about common terms. This is very, so re-education camps, right? And the participants on my side of the debate called them concentration camps, right? So immediately we have this row about terminology. And with lack of common terms, it's very hard to get beyond first base. So even then, when we get into the policy issues, the argument really was from my side that, okay, I thought maybe experience in Northern Ireland and the calamitous outcomes of aggressive security policy there in the early 70s, which I remember, it's the mid-70s, that this would be something, okay, we could admit that this is also, mistakes were made in security policy in Britain too, but it sort of really didn't get anywhere. I mean, the guy said, we're dealing with a different issue. It's, how can you understand? Central Asia has always been a vulnerability for us. If it wasn't you in the, Victorian period, it was the Russians. And then if it wasn't the Russians, it was, other people trying to come and stir things up. And, we cannot take chances with this. I guess you've got to also take a deep breath and admit at least some validity to China's concerns. I mean, but it's not easy. But I mean, I don't think they're doing this just because they love doing it. I mean, they obviously have a reason, even if it's hard to understand.
Thank you very much. My name is Idra. My question is, since you talk about Xi's life in Fujian, Zhejiang, and Shanghai, and that's decades, very well, most developed areas in China, why that kind of experience didn't change, or for some people, for him to be more open-minded or more pro-growth, sort of. I mean, I always have this question. Maybe similar with the background that his family got, persecuted a bit during Mao's time, but he still favors that. Any other things that you think influence his thinking towards economic policy and also political policies? Thank you.
From the things that I've seen, so, it's limited. Of course, it's limited. It's clear that he had a response to officials around him really making a lot of money and using the party as a money-making opportunity. So the only thing I can say that is kind of distinctive about him being in these fast-developing provinces was this response that the party needed to do politics, not business, and these officials were letting that mission down. And that's kind of, I'd say it was a moral response. I mean, I'm not saying this is an absolute moral position, but it was like kind of this idea that the party had an ethos that he believed in when a lot of people around him didn't. And although we can be distracted by his family, obviously did do business, his sister and I think his brother. As far as I know, he was always quite strict about wherever he worked, they weren't allowed to do business. So it was probably a distinctive position. And though it's very hard today to work out how he became the dominant leader up to 2012, I think that sort of conviction was maybe one of the reasons. In China, what is the least plentiful thing? Faith. In the Communist Party. I mean, if you're a one-eyed man, in a blind kingdom, you're going to be king. And I think Xi Jinping is this sort of example of someone who believed in something when no one else did. And that probably explains today why he's in this dominant position, because it's rare. It's very, very rare.
Thank you so much for sharing your expertise, for answering all of those questions that we had, so many different topics. I'm sorry to all of you who didn't get a chance to ask a question, but thank you again for coming in such large numbers. Thank you to the Lau Institute for hosting us here today. Don't forget that you can find some copies, I think, of Kerry's book about China through European eyes. It really is a really interesting book. I do recommend it. So, thank you to you, Kerry. Thank you to all of you. And goodbye from us at Asia Matters.